This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is actress Joan Cusack. During her career, she's received Academy Award nominations for her roles in two comedies, Working Girl, in which she played a secretary, and In and Out, in which she played a woman who finds out that her fiancé is secretly gay, a secret he's kept even from himself. In the film Broadcast News, it was Cusack who made the now famous last-minute dash into the control room with the tape clip that needed to get on the air. Cusack has co-starred in several films with her younger brother John Cusack, including Say Anything, Gross Point Blank, and Cradle Will Rock. Now she's in the new movie High Fidelity, based on the popular Nick Hornby novel. The movie stars her brother, John Cusack, as the owner of a used record store who's obsessed with records and with the reasons why his relationships never last. Joan plays his ex-girlfriend's good friend. In this scene, John is at a bar with Joan, hoping to get some advice about how to get his girlfriend back now that she's moved in with a new boyfriend. John's been calling their house a lot.
You have got to stop calling her. You're really upsetting her and him.
Care about him.
Well, you should.
Why?
Because all you're doing is forming a little unit. Them against you. Before you started all this psychotic madness, there was no unit. There was just three people in a mess. But now, they've got something in common. And you don't want to make anything worse.
How could it get any worse than Laura with Ian? Come on, Liz.
Can I ask you a question? And you can think about it if you want to.
Just what is it?
Why do you want Laura back so badly?
Joan Cusack, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
What did you relate to most about the story?
I think I was just so glad that he told a story about a guy's journey to commit to a relationship. I just think that's it. And he really sort of tells all their secrets, I think, in a way. And I just love that I didn't relate to his journey, but I related to the whole struggle of that.
Have you known a lot of guys who wouldn't commit?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it's a real growth thing. It's like, I mean, he says it in the movie. At some point, you just realize that fantasy doesn't deliver. And it's not that they guys or people, I mean, I think it's not just guys, too. It's women, too. But at a certain point, you just think, oh, do I have to settle and get deeper and really be who I really am deep down and see who this other person is really deep down? And, you know, it's not going to be all the flash and really get to the real part of things. And I think that's a hard transition in life.
Had you read the novel before you were cast in the movie?
I hadn't, actually. And so many people have told me since that, you know, God, it was just their favorite book. I don't know how it skipped me, but I read it afterwards.
You read it after you were cast or after you made it?
After I made it.
Why did you wait till afterwards?
Well, I don't know. I think I just thought I wanted to do this script and work on what John was doing. And I didn't know if it would change my perception of things.
Did it?
No, not really. I mean, I should have just read it. I don't know. Maybe I was just busy with my son or something.
Now, when your brother makes a movie, do you assume that he'll try to find a role for you in it?
You know, I don't assume it, but I always hope it because I love working with him, and I love supporting him because he's always done sort of more leading roles than I've done, and it's just a hard job to do that, and it's nice to have people around you to support you, and I just believe in him so much that I'm happy to be there and just be another ear too.
Now, when did you first work together? Did you work together as kids?
Well, he's 4 years younger than me. So, and we grew up doing theater and theater games together in Evanston. But when you're growing up, that's kind of a big difference. You know, I was going to high school and he was in fifth grade and then I was leaving high school. So we didn't really ever work together then. But we were in similar theater program in Evanston, right outside of Chicago, that was run by Bernard Joyce Piven that really kind of shaped the culture of our work. So we had a lot of similar experiences and vocabulary and that kind of stuff.
Tell me a little bit about what this children's theater was like.
It was Byrne and Joyce Piven who were members originally of the Compass Players, which came out of the University of Chicago that Mike Nichols and Elaine May were part of, and Ed Asner and Paul Sills. And it was sort of the 60s, and it was very sort of story theater, improvisation, kind of humanistic kind of theater work where you're developing as a human as well as an artist. It wasn't about putting on things. And it was more kind of developing from a creative, developing your creativity in performance. And Byrne and Joyce Piven, who were members of that club, just went on to start a theater for kids, which was just so wonderful. And it was just sort of a happenstance thing that my older sister and I did after school, like an after school thing. And I think my dad was always involved creatively and in creative writing. And so there was a real connection there anyway. And we just grew up doing that. Like, I think I was 7 and my sister was 8, and John did it when he got to be, I think, 7 or 8 too. And we did Ray Bradbury stories and J.D. Salinger and Chekhov, and it was just sort of this wonderful little jewel. And, it was just kind of a happenstance thing.
What were some of the ways that the adults around the theater got the children to think about self-transformation into a role?
A lot of it dealt with a story theater technique, which was sort of like you would be telling the story as well as being the character. So you would say, like if you were doing, we did a J.D. Salinger piece, like a Franny and Zoe, and you'd say, and then Franny picked up the phone and cradled it in her hand and spoke to Seymour. And so you were present on stage as a person, which allowed you to be yourself there, I think, philosophically in a way. You weren't like just becoming someone else. You were there and able to then use your feeling to transform into something or into that person. So it was much more accessible, strangely.
As the older sister, and you were 4 years older than John, were you more serious about theater at first, and were you supposed to look out for him?
Yeah, no, not really. I think I was just sort of busy doing it myself. And I think because he was, there was five kids in my family, so everyone was just sort of busy kind of doing their thing. And as soon as he actually started doing it, he was really good. And I think he started doing commercials in Chicago when he was like 12 or 13, and he started doing professional work kind of right away. So he kind of was launched on his own really, really soon.
What did you think? Were you envious, or you were actually making movies already yourself?
I had done like a little part in things, but I was in college at the time, and I think I was glad that I was in college, but it was just sort of amazing that he was sort of, just sort of taking off that way. And, if you ever meet him, he's such a great Irish politician in a way. It made perfect sense that he was off doing that.
What do you mean by a great Irish politician?
Well, he just, works the room and enjoys it and loves people and loves what he's doing. And he's very extroverted.
Now, your first film role was at the age of 15. You were in My Bodyguard. Describe your part.
Basically, I was just kind of a glorified extra. They were doing this movie, Martin Mull and Ruth Gordon and Chris Makepeace, and it was Tony Bill's movie. I think he had done another one before that, but I just played a kid in the classroom. It was sort of about a boy who takes on the sort of weird, sort of smoldering, who knows what's going on, brooding guy to be his bodyguard. And so it was sort of a classroom kid's story. And so I was one of the other kids in the classroom. And it was nice because I, you know, got the part and I couldn't believe it. And it, just being an extra in it, really. And then we started filming it. And Tony Bill said, you know, you have a nice energy. I think we're going to, you know, maybe, you know, have you do a few scenes with Chris and we'll write a few things for you. Would that be okay with you? And I was like, oh, my God, I couldn't believe it.
How did it affect your status in high school to have a small part in a real movie?
I think it just made me feel really good. I think there's like the popular girls were still the popular girls. And it was such a big high school and there were so many cliques and everything that, you know, I think, and it hadn't come out or anything, so no one really knew about it, but I knew about it, and it made me feel sort of special, which was great, because I needed all the help I could get in high school.
Now, you got in on the John Hughes era of filmmaking. You had a small part in 16 Candles. So tell us about your part in that.
That was... I think at that point, actually, it was like right before I was going to college, and I just had this, you know, silly part in it with my neck brace, but it was great.
Yeah,
was,
just describe the neck brace that you had to wear.
It was a neck brace, and I think it hooked onto my braces, or no, I don't think it did, actually. It was just sort of like if you were in a car accident kind of neck brace. That you just have to keep your neck still. And then it sort of goes over your shoulder, so it just sort of stabilizes you. And thus the comedy ensues.
So you had made at least two movies before you even got out of high school. Did that make you think, like, I got to do this, I got to keep doing this?
I think it was certainly encouraging. And actually now, you know, I realize how crucial that is to have experiences when you're younger that give you confidence, because it's such a hard job to stay confident in, because you don't have consistent work, and you can see when you go to an audition, you can see there's so many talented people, and how do you at that moment just feel like you can really do it?
You went to college. You went to the University of Wisconsin at Madison.
Uh-huh.
Did your parents insist that you go to college instead of just trying to go to Hollywood right away, or was that your idea?
They definitely supported going to college. They both had great experiences at their college, and the argument they said to me was that if you want to be an actor your whole life, you can. But this is a chance to learn about all the other parts of the world and all the other kinds of things that are going on. And, you know, the great, reading great Russian novels and learning about character from another point of view. And, you know, you'll always have that education and you can't, it's just so powerful.
Were they right?
I think so. I mean, I think obviously if you're Uta Hagen and you're studying acting as deeply as she does, you have that training of depth. But sometimes if you're just doing acting, you know, life upon life, or just feeling like once removed from life and studying that too long, I think you can, or I feel anyway, that you lose something, that having that background of just life itself as the most important thing and the most diverse thing really was powerful to me.
My guest is actress Joan Cusack. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Joan Cusack, and she co-stars in the new movie High Fidelity, which stars her brother John Cusack. In 1985 to 86, you were a cast member of Saturday Night Live. And were you out of college yet when you started doing this? You were out of college? How long out of college?
I actually had just gotten out of college.
So who else was in the cast with you during your year on Saturday Night Live?
Let's see, Nora Dunn and John Lovitz and Dennis Miller and Robert Downey Jr. and Randy Quaid and Denitra Vance. And Damon Wayans.
You know, it's funny. It's really a terrific group of actors, and yet it's hardly considered one of the high points in the history of Saturday Night Live. I wonder why that is.
I don't think anyone watched it that year at all. And they were going to cancel the show, actually, mm-hmm. that year. And Lorne Michaels, at the last minute, decided to come back. And I think maybe they had 2 months to kind of get everything together. And they sort of went with more sort of actory-type people than comedians, I think, was part of their thinking. But no one kind of got a chance to sort of get to know each other mm-hmm. that much beforehand, I think. And it was all so fast. And suddenly you were, you know, doing this live show. And so I don't know if that was part of it, too.
Did you write any of your own sketches?
No, I never sort of worked that way before. It was always sort of, I had done improv and theater. And, you know, suddenly I was in like an office building with typewriters and I was like, how do you do this? And, you know, a lot of it was like sort of like socializing and trying to figure out what you could do and getting to know the writers and seeing if you had similar sense of humor, and they'd come up with an idea and you could think, you know, if you could do that or make that work. Or, I sort of felt like I had, you know, nicely, I had those little bits of confidence that I felt like, you know, if someone wrote something, I could make it work or I could try to make it work. And so I kind of relied on that.
So did you have to compete for parts or lobby the writers for good parts?
That was sort of part of it, I think. It was a really, really competitive place, and the writers were all trying to compete to get their stuff on, and I think that I wasn't sort of, I know I was competitive and driven, but I didn't feel quite that aggressive. I wasn't that good at being aggressive in that way, I don't think.
Is it why you left after one season?
Well, yeah, I think. I mean, that, and they fired me.
Oh, that.
I like to think it was some choice I made. No, they just, it wasn't working. And it wasn't working for me, too. I was miserable. I think I wound up in the hospital, actually, and I had, like, some surgery, and it's just, like, horrible.
Did they operate on your stress glands or something?
Yeah. No, but it's, you know, I'm so grateful that I was on that show. Because, again, it was like, God, to have done that, you just have a little bit more confidence to do things. Even if it didn't go well. I felt so badly about it that I didn't make it on that show and it wasn't right for me. You know, that how could it, you know, I loved Gilda Radner and how could it have not worked out? And then I realized it wasn't the right environment for me. You know, that I was better doing theater stuff or just straight acting stuff.
Well, it certainly helped establish your identity as a comic actress.
Yeah.
Is that the identity you wanted, or did you want more dramatic parts too?
You know, I'd grown up doing both, but I sort of had always, you know, in our house, sort of comedy was a really important value. We grew up watching Mel Brooks movies and Monty Python and Fernwood Tonight and Mary Hartman. And, you know, my dad always played the producers in the backyard every summer. And
oh, great.
It was just like that was part of an important value that they were trying to pass on as comedy. So I think that was always in my heart. But, you know, I liked doing, you know, like diverse thing. I liked doing theater and more serious things, too.
Joan Cusack will be back in the second half of the show. Here's a scene from the comedy In and Out, for which she received an Academy Award nomination. It's her wedding night, but the wedding has been called off because the groom has just admitted he's gay. She's drinking in a bar, wearing her wedding dress, talking with a tabloid reporter played by Tom Selleck. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with actress Joan Cusack. She's in the new movie High Fidelity, which stars her brother, John Cusack. Her other films include Runaway Bride, In and Out, Working Girl, Say Anything, and Broadcast News. Let me ask you about one of the comic scenes that you're best known for, and this is the scene in Broadcast News in which you're the person who has to run down the hall from the office into the control room, delivering the video clips just a moment before it is due to be broadcast. Tell us how that scene was shot.
God, that actually is one of my favorite things I've ever done, that movie. I just think it's such a great film. But they shot it in lots of different pieces. And so it was like sort of a running, not running gag, but a running scene that we were shooting all through the film. There was maybe 7 or 8 pieces of it that we did at different times. And, it was, and at the end of it, I remember they gave me a huge, one of those horseshoe wreaths, like horses get at the end of a race. It was so cute and sweet.
We have a minute and a half. It's my responsibility to tell the control room and New York that we won't be ready.
We'll be ready.
In 84 seconds.
15 seconds.
Oh, God. You're saying, oh, God.
Lay it in, Bobby. Back out.
What was the trickiest part for you in that scene?
I think there was a part where they wanted me to slide under this filing cabinet, and they actually had like a stunt guy like helping me, and they sprayed silicone on the floor, and I had like newspapers, and I had like knee pads on. They wanted me to get really close to the filing cabinet, and I remember the stunt guy at the time was kind of out there, like a little Hollywoody, and he was like, "You've got to be the cabinet and then be underneath the cabinet," and I don't know what he was saying, but whatever. I just was like, "All right, I'll just try that." And anyway, I think I got really close to the cabinet, so that it was a little scary, actually. But it was, like my head did, like I almost hit it.
You got an Academy Award nomination for your role in Working Girl. Mm-hmm. You and Melanie Griffith played secretaries, and she is, through all these, mistaken identity things, ends up becoming
executive.
Executive, thank you, the word I was looking for. And so, particularly early in the movie, you both have really big hair.
Yeah.
How did you like yourself in this real teased high hair?
Well, I feel that it was like my kabuki performance. But honestly, the guy that did it, Roy Helland, he was the makeup and hair artist who'd worked with Liv Ullman for years and years and years. And he was a fascinating makeup art and hair artist. And he did the cool, it was such a, I know the secretaries on the Staten Island Ferry had 20 minutes from going from Staten Island to Manhattan, and everyone was jammed in the bathroom, and we actually went and took the ferry, at work time, teasing their hair. And so it was a do you could do in 20 minutes. They all came in just with their, having showered and did their makeup and hair on the boat. And he just turned it into such a craft. He actually like bleached the bottom of my hair just a tiny little bit, so it just looked like it was fried, not like it was, a color that had grown out, but actually just fried hair. And then, I think now about doing that, I'm just so grateful he was so good. Because it was really just it was like, totally enhanced the character. Was the whole, I barely had to do anything, and it was funny.
In the recent film Runaway Bride, you were Julia Roberts' friend. You've played a bunch of best friend kind of parts. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you like Eve Arden and the kind of prototypical best friend actors.
Yeah. I think Eve Arden did some great performances, really. And I actually have come to really like the best friend role. At first, I think because I did it in Working Girl 2, and I've done it before, and in Runaway Bride, I thought it wasn't really worth it for me to do it again unless I could sort of make it meaningful for myself in mm-hmm. some way, mm-hmm. and really say, wait a minute, if I'm going to be the best friend, I want to be what a best friend really is, and like really say something to my friend that a best friend would say or behave in a way that was meaningful in that way. And in that way, the part became meaningful to me. I think, you know, in general, I played a lot of character parts. And I found that to be a great kind of wonderful life as an actor because, you know, and I know it especially from John because he's always done kind of leading roles, that there's such a pressure on you and it's such a demanding schedule. And there's something wonderful about being able to go in and do your part and show up and support the film and be part of the story and not have to carry the whole thing and then go home and, you know, be a leading lady in your real life. So I've been really kind of grateful for those parts. They've really fit my life really nicely.
You know, for someone who's played the best friend in several films, I wonder if you have a best friend in real life, if you have time for friends in real life. You are the mother of two, I think. You're married. You have your film career. Do you have time for friends?
Yeah, I think, you know, and I love that about the kind of parts I've been able to have, that I do have time for that. And I've been able to, I think, live in Chicago and concentrate on having a marriage that works, that I try hard to make work, and a family. I'm actually 8 months pregnant.
Yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you.
This is your third?
It's my second, actually.
Oh.
But have friends and family and a social life and a culture and be part of a community, because, you know, as I just feel like those are the things that ultimately are the most meaningful. You know, that the extraordinary things in life are the ordinary things in life. I know that saying always sticks with me because I just find it to be so true. And I mean, what would you do without your friends in life? It just, and I'm, you know, it's easy for me to say I've had a great career and been able to make some money, but I mean it sincerely that it just doesn't, I just haven't found those things to be, you know, it's nothing like coming home and getting a hug from my son. It's just not that. It's just so much more powerful.
When you realized that a lot of Hollywood was going to be about how much do you weigh and how beautiful are you, did you feel in a way like you were back in high school and the popular right. kids were ruling the world?
Right. It is like that. It's kind of a very, I mean, I don't mean to be judgmental. It's just for me anyway, I think. It's just a very, you know, juvenile kind of thinking, ultimately. You know, it's not very sophisticated. and Hollywood is more than that. I think there's incredibly creative, talented people there, and, you know, lots of, especially, well, not now. I mean, I think there's always been amazing women doing amazing things out there, and men, and you just have to find them. But if your mindset is stuck feeling like you've got to fit into this perfect world and have everything look perfect, it's just never-ending failure.
I want to wish you good luck with your new baby.
Oh, thank you.
And will you stop working for a while until...
I'm going to do a sitcom with Jim Brooks in Chicago, starting probably the mid-season replacement. Yeah, and that it's great because
so you can stay home and work.
So I'm going to stay. I get to stay, live, and work in the same place, and have a kind of a very structured, sort of stable working life, and have a family. And I'm so lucky and thrilled and happy that Jim Brooks is willing to come to Chicago and work a little bit because he's going to do it in Chicago.
And Jim Brooks did the Mary Tyler Moore Show and Broadcast News, in which you co-starred. So what's the sitcom going to be about?
It's actually based on this woman, Gwen Macsai, who's done pieces for NPR. It's kind of based on her life, and it's about being heroic, I think, in a marriage and sort of trying to shrug off neurosis. And she has a book that just came out, Lipstick, that's really great, that sort of has the feel of her humor. And she's really, and Jim Brooks heard her on NPR and her little pieces and sort of contacted her, I think, 5 years ago. And I had contacted him probably 5 or 6 years ago, too, about trying to do a sitcom. And he said, oh, well, there's serendipity to these things, and which wasn't what I wanted to hear at the time. But now it's really great because she's come along and written quite a bit now and is really going to write the show and lives in Chicago. And it's really, really exciting.
Well, I wish you the best, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's just a pleasure.
Joan Cusack is in the new film High Fidelity, which opens next week. It stars her brother, John Cusack. He'll be our guest next week. Coming up, Ted Heller, author of the new novel Slab Rat, a satire of the magazine industry. This is Fresh Air.